This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Francine Prose about a newly discovered literary genius.
He's certainly up there with Primo Levi, let me put it that way, which is, you know, very high praise.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Pamela Paul chats with us about YA literature and the essay she wrote for our back page.
A lot of YA fiction explores often very serious themes, but without the cynicism and irony that you would see in a grown-up book.
Mary Roach talks about being a virtual astronaut and her new book, Packing for Mars. And Jennifer Schussler has bestseller news.
This episode of the New York Times Book Review Podcast is brought to you by voice-activated Sync, the easy-to-use in-car connectivity system, which gives you voice control of mobile phones and MP3 players and features audible turn-by-turn directions and 911 assist. Available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
It's rare. In fact, I can't think of the last time that a reviewer used the words masterpiece and genius on the cover of the New York Times Book Review, but a major critic, Francine Prose, does this week in her review of two novels by Hans Carlsen, a Dutch writer. They're called The Death of the Adversary and Comedy in a Minor Key. Both are new translations of novels that were published a generation or more ago. Welcome, Francine.
Thanks. Thanks, Sam.
So had you heard of Hans Carlsen before?
No, I hadn't. Like most other readers, I would imagine. I was really astonished because it's not as if there's been a shortage of fiction and films and nonfiction about the Holocaust and what that period was like to live through. So I approached the book thinking, okay, I'm interested, but what could possibly be new that I'm going to find? And I was astonished by how new it made everything. And I found myself saying, why hasn't anyone done this before? Why hasn't anyone written about it in a way that feels so true and so persuasive and so plausible, and yet it hasn't appeared?
Well, what is new about it? What's he doing that hasn't
been
done?
Well, the two books are quite different. I mean, Comedy in a Minor Key is about this couple, sort of newly married, I guess they've been married 3 years, Dutch couple.
And when was this first published, Francine? Since Carlsen
Comedy
is
in a Minor Key, I can't remember. It's never come out in English before. Mm. I think the other one, Death of the Adversary, came out in the 60s.
Mm. Okay.
So in between the war and the 60s. But it's about this Dutch couple who are, they're not particularly heroic. They agree to hide a Jewish man because someone tells them, there's a guy who's been working for the resistance who says it's their patriotic duty. They're not particularly reflective, and they're not, what they're certainly not, is heroic. They're not like Mies Kiep or the people that hid Anne Frank. I mean, they're, you know, they're just sort of kind of ordinary, bumbling, you know, they don't particularly think about the dangers. And in fact, they're out in the country, so it's not as if they feel the Gestapo breathing down their neck all the time. So it's all about sort of the quotidian daily life of what it's like. And then, I mean, this happens early on in the novel. The guy they're hiding dies of natural causes. And there's the wife is so upset because she's not even going to get credit for having done this, you know, brave thing. I mean, she'd had this fantasy of the war is over and they're going to move into this, all go out into the sunshine, and the neighbors are going to say, oh, you were so brave and so forth. A, it's not going to happen, and B, they've got to figure out a way to dispose of the body of someone they've become sort of fond of. Then on the other side, the guy they're hiding, who they call Nico, you know, you read Anne Frank and the gratitude and the appreciation for their Dutch helpers. It's just nonstop. It's just, you know, it's pure and it's deserved. But there's an amazing scene where Nico comes downstairs to where the couple's been living, and he sees this Chinese vase they have. And of course, he thinks sort of briefly about what he's given up, but not very. And he just hates them. He just hates them. I mean, he knows they've saved his life, but he just hates their stupid Chinese vase. Reading it, you think, this is something that no one has said before. It's so multifaceted and it's so nuanced and it's so human that all the kind of categories in which we think of that experience, hero, victim, savior, rescuer, blah, 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 had to be much more complicated than that.
And who was Hans Carlsen?
He was a German physician who had to leave Germany when the Nuremberg laws came in. He, like his characters, he was hidden in the Netherlands. He moved to the Netherlands. He became
He's Jewish.
He's Jewish, yeah. He became a resistance worker, and then and since the war, after the war, he became a psychiatrist. Oh, I guess he was a doctor, specialized in psychiatry, specializing in children who have been affected by trauma, particularly Holocaust trauma, but I think other kinds of trauma as well. Reading it, you feel that his skills as a psychiatrist or whatever he's observed or has taught himself to observe go directly into the fiction, so the complications of these characters are fantastic.
Now, when an accomplished novelist and renowned critic like yourself uses the words masterpiece and genius, you're putting him in a very select category of writers. Is this one of the greatest of modern novelists?
Well, he's certainly one of the very greatest who wrote about that period. He's certainly up there with Primo Levi. Let me put it that way, which is, you know, very high praise. I mean,
so as a narrative writer, as a prose writer, as a describer of characters, as a conveyor of atmosphere and mood, all these things.
All these things. I mean, the books are very short. That's the other thing, is that how concentrated they are. And also, as a formal innovator, even though he doesn't seem particularly aware that he's doing innovation formally. I mean, for example, Death of the Adversary is about a guy who's a Jewish guy in Germany, young man, who's obsessed with Hitler, understandably. But the word Nazi is never mentioned. The word Hitler is never mentioned. It's only tangentially obvious that the guy is Jewish at all. So, because those things can't be spoken of. They just can't be mentioned. But they're these extraordinary, inventive. I mean, at some point, his friend who's become, and everyone he knows is becoming a Nazi, basically. His friend's become a Nazi, tells him a story about elks and wolves. I can't, the Tsar and the Kaiser involved, and one of the, gives the other a group, a present of a herd of elks. And the elks start dying out because, says the friend, they need the wolves. Without the wolves, the elks can't live. And this is supposedly supposed to be a story about Jews and Nazis, you know, I mean, but because the narrator's psychology is so complex, he takes the story and turns it over and turns it over, and it keeps coming back through the narrative. I mean, likewise, the scene that I wrote about in the review, there's this stunning scene that our hero has a kind of crush on this girl he's working with at a department store, and she brings him to her house. They're going to have dinner. And her brother comes in, and her brother is a brown shirt thug and with his friends. And one of the friends tells a story. And it's basically, it's about the desecration of a Jewish cemetery. And again, I was thinking, why hasn't that been written about in that way before from a first-person point of view, basically? I mean, something you can only do in fiction in a certain way. I mean, so there's no violence against human beings. I mean, we all know the stories of the roundups, the stories of the deportations, the stories of the camps. And we also know that there was a great deal of cemetery desecration. But finally, there it is. And somehow, by the end of that scene, you understand how people who have no inclination or little inclination to violence can be made extremely violent. It's just by the end of that scene. And also, you can hardly breathe reading it because it's so painful. Because how is it told? It's told to a room full of people, one of whom is Jewish. Everyone knows who everybody is. Everybody knows what everybody is. But again, it's not spoken. Formally, it's just mind-blowing.
Thanks a lot, Francine.
You're welcome.
That's Francine Prose, who this week reviews two novels by Hans Carlsen on the cover of the New York Times Book Review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
Barnes & Noble, it used to be the huge sort of Leviathan, and now what's slinking away?
Well, not yet. I mean, yes, we think of Barnes & Noble from, you know, its reputation as the big monster, scary, mega chain. But now, this week, its board announced that it is putting the company up for sale, which might mean that Len Riggio, the chairman and largest shareholder of the company, just wants to take it private and figure out the digital strategy without all of these quarterly reports and shareholders to deal with. But it does seem to be at an impasse. I mean, this company has to figure out, it has 720 stores.
Nationwide.
Nationwide. It has about 600 college bookstores. And it has to figure out how it can survive as well digitally as it has physically.
Okay, so what's brought this impasse on? Is it the rise of the ebook or Amazon or both?
Both and many more things. I mean, certainly the rise of the ebook, which has taken off much more quickly than a lot of publishers predicted. In the first 5 months of 2009, ebooks made up about 3% of total trade book sales. And in the same period this year, they're about 8.5%, which is a very big rise, and it's probably only going to grow even faster now that e-readers only cost about $150 instead of $250.
Aren't there still, though, lots of people who just go to their Barnes & Noble and go to Starbucks and hang out and then maybe buy a book or not? I mean, are there sales really?
There are still a lot. Yeah. I mean, their store traffic has gone down a lot in the last 2 years, which has a lot to do with the sluggish economy, which has affected book retailers much more than average retailers. But the Starbucks cafes inside the stores certainly helps, and a lot of analysts have said that that was a brilliant move and something that was very smart. However, they still have a lot to deal with. They still have to decide or figure out if the browsing experience is going to remain or if Barnes & Noble stores and other big superstores will go the way of Sam Goody and Virgin stores. That's the fear.
Barnes & Noble stores are also, especially in Manhattan, important to publishers and authors, right? They give readings there. They do book signings. Is that business still thriving as far as you know?
I mean, they're hugely important to publishers. Publishers very much want Barnes & Noble to do well. They're still the largest bookseller. They make up a huge part of their business. And they're very energetic, very enthusiastic booksellers, and they know how to sell books. They know how to sell print books, that is. It remains to be seen if they know how to sell digital books. And they are very good about readings, about promoting authors. And publishers are very, very high on Barnes & Noble.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook to consider is How Did You Get This Number? By Sloane Crosley. This second collection of personal essays reflects on everything from life in New York City to bridesmaid duty in Alaska. That's How Did You Get This Number? By Sloane Crosley, available from Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
It's no news we're living in the golden age of young adult fiction. Only now it's more and more grown-ups who are reading it. Pamela Paul, great journalist and frequent contributor to the New York Times Book Review, has written a back-page essay called The Kids' Books Are All Right, and it's about how many adults, herself included, really love young adult fiction. Pamela's here to talk about it. Hi, Pamela.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you belong to this kind of high-powered book club where you read kids' books.
Yeah. There's this incredible sort of disjunction between the people who are in the Kid Lit Book Club, which there are publishers, very high-powered agents, a number of authors of adult novelists and YA novelists in the group. And we get together and read things like Diary of a Wimpy Kid.
How come?
Well, you know, I think in part it's probably a bit of an escape from what everybody does in their real lives. But I think that also there is a merit to YA literature, both contemporary and classic, that I think gets overlooked by the kids who are actually reading them.
And it seems to come at a time, you suggest in the piece, where grown-up or adult fiction in the postmodernist era has gotten more and more complex and self-referential and maybe less and less about characters and stories. And YA fiction still preserves those values? Is that part of it?
Yes, definitely. I mean, Lev Grossman, I think, put it really well. I mean, he said that there are just so many novels where, you know, it's this sort of very MFA-driven fiction where you're spending 15 pages, you know, watching somebody make coffee. In 15 pages of The Hunger Games, you know, you've crossed 10 districts and, you know, fought against the Capitol and three people have been slain. And, you know, there's real action and character development that I think often feels lacking from a lot of contemporary fiction.
And yet, really to prove your point, some quite prominent contemporary authors are now writing YA fiction themselves, and you mentioned some in the piece.
Yes. I mean, there's James Patterson, who seems to write everything, Francine Prose, just the new John Grisham book is YA. And, you know, a lot of writers that who I know personally have been urged by their agents and publishers to go YA because, sadly, it's one of the few growth areas in publishing. But it's also, I think, a place where John Burnham Short said that a lot of writers can kind of have this freedom to write the great coming-of-age novel, you know, that they never wrote, but perhaps with less pressure. There's just an ease to it and a pleasure in writing them.
So it's more fun for the authors themselves. In a way, they're recovering some of the great themes of literature or of the novel that have maybe disappeared from the more serious fiction today.
Yes, and you know, and there are serious YA, but I think that really when you talk to the people who read it, it's also just a lot of YA fiction explores often very serious themes, but it does so in a way that's really feels refreshing and new because it's about characters who are experiencing these seemingly life and death decisions, but without the cynicism and irony that you would see in a grown-up book.
Now, when you get together in a book club with a publisher like Jonathan Burnham or a critic like Lev Grossman at Time Magazine and writer like yourself with several books under your belt, what's there to discuss?
Oh, people argue. I mean, there are furious debates that, you know, a lot of the conversation ends up revolving, going back to a constant theme, which is what makes a book YA? Is it YA because the protagonist is a child or a young adult? Does it have to be a coming-of-age novel? Jennifer Joel says that basically all great YA has to be a coming-of-age novel. But then, of course, you have books like Wuthering Heights, you know, which is commonly considered a YA book. But when you look at the themes that are in there in the action, it's really not a child's story.
And it certainly wasn't written as one.
Right. And a lot of things, books sort of become de facto YA, I think mostly because high school curricula designers decide that that's what they are. And, you know, a lot of it is just, you know, is the book any good? And sometimes there are deep divisions within the group. Although I would say that there is unanimity on The Hunger Games, which I opened this essay with, which is a trilogy. The third one is due out in a few weeks, and everyone basically likes those. But we end up debating the themes within.
And what's the new book in that series?
The new book is Mockingjay by Suzanne Collins, who interestingly, I think, started out writing things like Clifford's Puppy Days and now writes these incredibly dark dystopian novels.
Which is already topping Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. There's a huge eager audience waiting for this novel.
Yeah, I think, you know, YA novels are in a certain way like really good contemporary TV, like Mad Men or, you know, The Sopranos, in that the authors often write trilogies or ongoing series where you really get to stick with the characters and get to know them, and they're really engrossing. And that just doesn't happen in grown-up fiction.
Thanks a lot, Pamela.
Thank you.
That's Pamela Paul, whose essay, The Kids' Books Are All Right, is published on the back page of this week's book review.
This episode of the New York Times Book Review podcast is brought to you by voice-activated Sync, the in-car connectivity system which gives you voice control of your Bluetooth-enabled mobile phone and most MP3 players.
Sync features turn-by-turn directions, 911 assist, real-time traffic and weather, music with the sound of your voice, and text messages read aloud. All hands-free, so you can keep your hands on the wheel and eyes on the road. Available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
We hear often about the heroism of astronauts, but not much about the yucky stuff they have to do to get up into space. Mary Roach has written a new book. It's called Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. It's reviewed for us this week by M.G. Lord, who calls it hilarious, filled with slapstick scenes, and says Roach elicits amazing confidences from the people she interviewed. Mary Roach was in the building recently, and we chatted about her new book. Mary Roach, people call you the most entertaining science writer in America. You've got a new book. It's called Packing for Mars. You were a kind of virtual astronaut for a couple of years. Tell us about it.
I was. I took advantage of the fact that NASA has all these simulations. Anything they're going to do up there, they do down here, which means sort of you can almost go to space without leaving home, which is what I did. I tried out the shuttle training toilet room. I was up on Devon Island where they were doing a simulated rover expedition. I was over at the bed rest facility where they simulate zero gravity by having people lie in bed for 3 months at a time without getting up at all. I was not a subject. I draw the line somewhere.
In the book, you say that it's not the heroism of the astronauts that interests you so much. It's all the bizarre, awful stuff they had to go through to get there. Talk about some of it. We're a family program, but tell us about some of it.
Yeah, you could kind of call this book the wrong stuff, the gross stuff. Coca-Cola, at a certain point, wanted very badly to have their product in space, Pepsi, too.
Like global or universal product placement.
Universal product placement. On the International Space Station, the shuttle, they've spent $450,000 to come up with a carbonation device for zero gravity, because bubbles, you know, zero gravity, everything weighs the same, so the gas doesn't rise to the surface. So what that means in a human stomach, normally, when you swallow air or carbonation, it all rises to the top of the stomach where it could then be expelled when you belch, and then you feel better. So the astronauts would drink Coca-Cola and go, Coca-Cola, tasty beverage, and then realize that they were feeling more and more bloated and uncomfortable. And I talked to a resident food scientist from NASA at the time, who said, unfortunately, burps were accompanied by a liquid spray, because you would burp, but then some of the liquid on top would come in. So it was very unpleasant and distasteful. So that was so much for Coca-Cola and beer, sadly.
There's a serious side to your book, too. You say that there are really two types of people who go into space. We think of the astronauts, the right stuff guys, but there's really a whole other group who are doing very important work.
Right. Well, the right stuff guys, those were really important when it was a small mission and very few people had gone. You wanted people to be really aggressive and brave and self-starters and fearless. But now you got six people for a long time in a can together with no way to get out, no way to, you know, slam the door and go for a drive. So you want kind of people who play well together.
And some of them are kind of nerdly types, right? These are scientists.
What kind of work are they doing? You've got engineers, you've got biomedical researchers, there is likely to be nerds as kind of like macho military guys. There's still a lot of people with a military background, but I have one of those. I have this poster of the astronaut corps, the NASA astronaut corps, and I was looking at, you know, they all look like really, really nice people, but they don't look like the right stuff, you know.
Place you couldn't go? Anything you weren't allowed to see?
I had this desire to, when the shuttle lands, I wanted to go right on board. Like, I wanted to experience, like, what does it smell like in there after a 2-week mission? Because you can't take a shower in space because the water just forms these blobs. So you're using your moist towelettes, which is, yeah. One astronaut I spoke to, she told me that they give you enough underwear to change it every other day, but she'd gotten it from anywhere from 5 to 7 days. So.
Thanks a lot, Mary Roach.
Thanks, Sam.
Jennifer Schussler's here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, we've got a new book at number one on the fiction list. Daniel Silva is back with the latest adventure of his swashbuckling art restorer / assassin, Gabriel Allen. His latest caper is called The Rembrandt Affair. Stieg Larsson drops to number two.
And, poor Stieg.
Yeah, I think he's looking a little shaky. His domination may be coming to an end. Previous installments of his trilogy have been number one and two on both the trade and mass market fiction lists. This week, Michael Connelly's Nine Dragons takes the number two spot on the mass market list. So I don't know about Stieg, but he apparently has become the first author in Amazon's so-called Million Kindle Club. That means he's the first writer to pass 1 million in total Kindle ebook downloads. That's just an Amazon store. And it turns out he's way ahead of the pack. There are only four other authors who have even had 500,000 Kindle downloads. That's Charlene Harris, you know, Vampire Queen, Nora Roberts, Stephanie Meyer, and James Patterson. But, you know, just to keep things in a little bit of perspective, James Patterson may only have, you know, 500,000 or so career Kindle downloads, but last year he sold a total of 14 million books. So the dead tree publishing model is far from dead, despite what Amazon would like to tell us.
Wow, that's a lot of copies. You know what it makes me realize, Jenny, is we have come a full cycle since the dominance of J.K. Rowling. She was pre-ebook. She's not on this list at all.
Oh, interesting. That's a very good point. Well, I suspect that if she... when she does publish a new book, she's going to be up there.
What about the nonfiction list?
All is Right with the World. Justin Halpern is back on top with Stuff My Dad Says. And Laura Ingraham had a very short time in the sun at number one. Her Obama Diaries drops to number two. Not a lot of news on the list. There's one new title, and it's actually quite an interesting one and a surprising one. It's called The Disappearing Spoon, and it's by a science writer named Sam Keen, who basically takes us on a sort of engrossing tour of the periodic table. So who knew that's what people wanted to read about this summer?
What does the title refer to?
Well, it refers to the amazing properties of the metal gallium, which apparently melts at 84 degrees Fahrenheit. And it's a common prank among chemists to fashion it into a spoon and then give it to somebody with their tea and watch the look on their face when it sort of melts into a quick silvery puddle on the surface of their Earl Grey.
Those chemists will get you every time.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
This is Jocelyn. Before we go, Sam's got to get something off his chest.
You know, Jocelyn, lots of times we hear from readers who wonder why it is that our fiction reviews are so often written by professional critics and not by fiction writers.
Why is that?
Well, one reason is almost every time we go to a fiction writer and ask them if they're interested in reviewing short stories or a novel, they say, "Can I read the book first and then decide?" Which we don't love, because that implies to us that they want to actually like the book before they review it. And that feels like they're setting our readers up.
But isn't it kind of they're trying to take a look at it and see whether it's better than what they write, or is it too similar to what they write? Is there some kind of competition going on?
We think that's our job. If a novel comes in and another novelist seems to us to have a sensibility that might mesh with this one, it seems to us, that's professional enough. We've made that call. We're happy to let them weigh in on it. It feels more as if they're worried about giving offense than they are about showing a sense of competition. Sense of competition is fine. Bring it on the page. Let the reader decide for himself if somebody is writing out of envy or spite or an inferiority complex. But why try to game the system? To us, that seems to reinforce a lot of preconceptions readers have that writers are more concerned about the personal nature of their profession than they are about the work itself.
So what can you do to root this out?
If anybody's got an answer, let me know. All we can do now is when they say, "Can I see the novel?" we say, "No." You've got to take a little bit of a risk when you accept the assignment, and we'll give you the credit to assume you're going to write the most honest and candid and thoughtful review you can.
You tell them, Sam.
Thanks, Jocelyn. Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.